Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute, Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. And on this podcast today, we have on the show with us again, Dennis Wagner, Executive Director of the Access Research Network. Dennis comes on the show around the end of each year to talk to us about a service that ARN provides, which is cataloging the top 10 science stories of each year. And we've previously had Dennis on two other podcasts talking about some of the top Darwin and Design science stories of 2010. And we're finally going to get down to the top five Darwin and Design science stories for 2010. Before we get started, Dennis, can you tell us where can our listeners go on your website to download this list of the top 10 stories for this year?
Sure, Casey. It's at www.arn.org/top10, and that's 10, so T-O-P-10. We actually have all the stories there for the last 5 years that we've been doing this. And I also like to mention that there are links on those PDFs that you can download taking you to places where these stories were reported, and for your listeners, we get those primarily from three places throughout the year. One is ARN itself. We have a science literature blog that reports frequently on new science articles that impact this whole Darwin Design area. Also, your website, evolutionnews.org, some great articles on science news there. And then also the Creation Evolution headlines, which you can find at crev.info. So those are three great resources for people to check throughout the year for these breaking stories. But sometimes we don't have time to keep up with it all, so it's fun to look back through those sources and find what we think are the top stories of the year that really influence our thinking about the future of Darwin and design theories.
Well, let's get into the top five Darwin and design stories for 2010. The number five story deals with convergent evolution, but not the sort of convergent evolution that we're often accustomed to hearing, types of convergence where fish and sharks have a similar shape for swimming through the water. In this case, we're talking about convergent genetic evolution. And I think that Simon Conway Morris had a very telling statement in one of his books where he said that convergent evolution makes a lot of biologists feel like the ghost of teleology is looking over their shoulder. Now we're seeing convergent evolution at the genetic level, at the DNA code level. What can you tell us about this story that found convergent evolution at the genetic level?
Well, it appeared in the September issue of Trends in Genetics, and it really just described how widespread convergent evolution is at the genetic level. And the problem for the neo-Darwinian theory is that it isn't supposed to be goal-directed. And so when you have chance processes working, you shouldn't be coming up with the same solution, so to speak, over and over again. And yet that's what convergent evolution, both on the genetic and the morphological level, communicates. And so these genetic sequences and features appearing independently over and over again, it's just not something you'd expect from the neo-Darwinian theory.
Let's talk about another thing that you wouldn't expect from the neo-Darwinian theory, and that is molecular machines with shape-shifting proteins that mediate spin direction on a rotary engine. This was the number four story, Dennis, and it talked about a discovery of how the bacterial flagellum can mediate its spin direction through a shape-shifting protein. Can you tell us about this finding?
Yeah, Casey, this article appeared in the August 19th issue of Nature, and it basically described this protein that can undergo rapid changes to its shape while the flagellum is spinning. And so that's one of the mechanisms that helps the flagellum rotor change direction so rapidly. It's going at hundreds of revolutions per second one direction, and it can suddenly change and go in the other direction. And when they started looking at this, they found that this protein actually changed shapes in a synchronous way, and it was really like watching water ballet dancers, the way this thing changed. And so you begin to wonder, well, how do these proteins, how are they orchestrated in a synchronous way to be able to change shapes to accommodate something like this? And there's a fantastic visual little animation online from Nature magazine. We have a link to that in our top 10 stories. And, pictures worth 1,000 words, so I recommend you go on and take a look at this thing, and I think you'd just be amazed that this is electrical, mechanical, very complex structural system that's creating this very complex feature in the flagellum.
Yes, I would definitely encourage our listeners to go check out the links from the ARN Top 10 website and check out this animation of the shape-shifting protein. It really is quite striking in the way that it works in a coordinated fashion to change the spin direction on the flagellum. Let's get to the number three story, and this dealt with biomimetics, or when engineers mimic biology to improve their technological designs. So, of course, you have intelligently designed technology, which is finding its inspiration in supposedly unintelligently designed biological systems. Oh, this is always a fun thing to talk about, Dennis. What can you tell us about this story from 2010?
My source for this was Creation Evolution Headlines, and they like to catalog these kind of things there. And there's three different articles that we link to where they report over 10 stories each time that appear in the scientific literature. And I'll just give you, like I said, there's over 30 of them there just in these three catalogs alone. But let me just give you a couple of samples. Caltech scientists who are studying jellyfish in order to build a better aquatic pump. So there's kind of a mechanical thing. German engineers who are building a robotic arm inspired by the design of the elephant trunk. European team of scientists is building a robotic arm with inspiration from the octopus limb. Swimsuits and ship hulls that are now being patterned after shark skin. Students at the University of Texas, Dallas, that are trying to harness the chemical sensing capability of bacteria to build synthetic sensors for toxins. And finally, my favorite, I think, is researchers are pursuing a new lightweight and high-performance materials based on a new spider species found in Madagascar that spins silk twice as strong and twice as elastic as any previously studied. They're referring to this as the toughest biomaterial ever seen. And they claim that it's 10 times stronger than Kevlar, which is, you know, they make suits out of to repel bullets. So this stuff is just incredible. So, again, the point I like to make on this, being that my background is engineering, is that in order to reverse engineer a system, it had to be engineered in the first place. And so here we are harvesting, so to speak. We call this the biomimetic gold rush. Technology companies are just rushing to nature and biological systems in particular to understand how they work because they're so much more advanced, even the simple spider silk, than things that we know how to create, that we're learning incredible things just by reverse engineering what's already been designed in nature.
Dennis, that's very fascinating, and it's always great to hear about the new ways that engineers are finding they can mimic biology. Let's talk about the number two story, and I think that this is a story that deserves mention, even if this was not a list of science stories that were dealing with Darwin and design. If you were just talking about breakthrough scientific discoveries, period, of 2010, this is perhaps one of the most important stories, and that is the discovery of what was called a second genetic code. It was the splicing code that basically tells RNA transcripts how they can be spliced together to potentially create new proteins. I've sort of given a little bit of a taste of what this discovery is. I think it's great that it is on the list of Darwin Design Science Stories because this obviously has huge implications for origins. And if you are having multiple codes and codes within codes, where do codes come from? I think that there are major design implications here. But what can you tell us about your number two story, the discovery of a second genetic code?
Yeah, Casey, there's an article that appeared in the May issue of Nature News that talked about the efforts of some researchers at the University of Toronto in Canada to define a second genetic code. You know, the first code, one of the beauties of that was its simplicity. You had the letters of DNA that can be combined in 64 different ways to encode for the 20 standard amino acids that form a protein. But now they have found that there's a second genetic code, one that predicts how segments of the messenger RNA transcribed from a given gene can be mixed and matched to yield multiple products in different tissues, a process called alternative splicing. This time there's no simple table, in its place are algorithms that combine more than 200 different features of DNA with predictions of RNA structure. And so we have a more complex code than we had in the first DNA code, and also we have now algorithms that are required to combine with the first code. So the complexity is even more than we dreamed, and the article seems to miss the obvious implication that, you know, more codes and more algorithms means more design, not less design.
Okay, well, thank you, Dennis. We're now up to the top Darwin and design science story for 2010. And I think this is one that certainly deserves to be near the top. This is a story that rebuts one of the most common arguments we hear against intelligent design. In essence, we're often told that the vertebrate eye is a poor or suboptimal design, and this has to do with the way that the optic nerve supposedly jets out over the retina. It doesn't actually affect your vision if you have two eyes. As a matter of fact, if you even have one eye, the impact upon vision is almost negligible. But in any case, in essence, we're told that no rational engineer would ever design the vertebrate eye the way it's designed. Now, this study that came out in April of 2010 and was published in Physical Review Letters shows that the design of the optic nerve and the way that it jets out over the retina is perhaps an extremely efficient design that actually helps to improve our visual acuity. So, Dennis, if you could walk us through this top story for 2010 and why scientists are now saying that the design of the vertebrate retina is actually a good design.
Yeah, they go beyond good. They call it optimal. For a design engineer, you know, you don't get any better than optimal. I mean, that's the best of all your design constraints. And this was research done by some physicists at the Israel Institute of Technology, where they actually modeled some of the things that were going on at the eye and discovered these things. And one of the reasons this is so important is Richard Dawkins loves to use the design of the vertebrate eye as an example of evolution, saying, obviously, nobody would design an eye like this. It's wired backwards. And what he means by that is that the photoreceptors, the rods and the cones, are at the back of the retina rather than being at the top of the retina, where you would think logically they would be to best receive the light coming in. But by being at the back, they've got a layer of translucent optical nerves that are in front of them. And so that, you would think, would diffuse the light that would be coming in. And so they often refer to the octopus or the squid, who has it reversed, as, you know, a better design. Well, that's nonsense, because we know the octopus and the squid don't have very good sight, and not as good as humans with the design of the eye the way we have it. And they can't see color. There's some other limitations to their eye. Well, as we've learned more about the human eye, we learned that these photoreceptors have to be at the back because there's some mechanisms behind that that provide a cooling function. But getting down to the science of this article, which was described in the Physical Review Letter in the April 2010 issue, they found out there's this, what they call a Müller cell, that acts as a fiber optic cable that actually goes through this translucent area of nerves and actually provides better, what they call, optimal light transfer compared to, say, the design of the octopus light. And it's actually kind of funneled at the top, and so it's actually better than a fiber optic cable, which, you know, is just kind of a point-to-point wire. But this actually kind of has a funnel capability at the top, brings in the max amount of light, and transmits it through the nerve area that Dawkins thought was a dumb design and into the photoreceptor cells with a much less loss of light than any other kind of design that we could have had. So not only does it explain a lot about why the vertebrate eye is designed the way it is, we find out that it's optimally designed and a much better system than, I think, anything that Dawkins had in mind that evolution would produce.
Expecting a retraction from Dawkins then pretty soon, Dennis?
Yeah, I'm sure he'll be issuing a press statement shortly after this podcast.
Well, Dennis, we've now gone through the top 10 Darwin Design Science Stories of the Year for 2010. Of course, there are many, many other stories that are exciting. We've seen in 2010 a very significant number of peer-reviewed scientific papers published by ProID scientists. A lot of those have been covered on evolutionnews.org. We saw the introduction of the premier intelligent design peer-reviewed scientific journal, Biocomplexity. That's something else that's been talked about here on ID the Future quite a bit. So the science behind intelligent design is being pushed forward, I would say, by both ProID scientists and scientists who don't even consider themselves ProID, and yet the discoveries they're making are unwittingly furthering the argument for intelligent design year by year. Well, Dennis, I have one quick question for you, and that is, why didn't Michael Behe's paper in Quarterly Review of Biology make it into your top 10 Darwin Design Science Stories for 2010?
Well, as you noticed, the publication date on that was December 15th, and we're now at, what, December 22nd? And obviously, we spent a lot of time collating these stories and putting them together, so we just didn't have time to work that one in. The wheels were already spinning on our stories at that point. So my only advice to Behe is wait till January 15th 15th next time, and he can make the top 10 list.
Well, and of course, according to Jerry Coyne, that paper had nothing to do with intelligent design anyway, so it doesn't belong in your top 10 anyway, right?
Oh, okay. That if Jerry says it, it must be true.
Yeah, well, if that makes Jerry Coyne feel better, then he can keep believing that.
That's right.
In any case, I'm sure that next year we'll have lots more interesting stories, and who knows, maybe Michael Behe's paper will make next year's list. Is there anything you'd like to add, Dennis, before we close out the top 10 science stories of 2010?
No, as we discussed earlier, we have two other top 10 lists we hope to publish here shortly, one focusing on the top cultural or media stories that had to do with, oh, maybe lawsuits or how this topic's being taught in schools or court cases. And then the other one is the top 10 Darwin and Design resources. And so hopefully we'll get a chance to come back and talk about some of those top stories from 2010 with your listeners also.
Great, Dennis. And again, if you want to go check out ARN's top 10 Darwin and Design science stories for 2010 or any of their other top 10 stories, go to the website arn.org/top10. Dennis, thanks again for coming on the show with us and talking about the top 10 stories as you do each year.
My pleasure, Casey.
Well, I'm Casey Luskin with ID of the Future. It's definitely been a good year. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.